announced this series talk, one of our friends wanted to know how we could take five evenings to it, when really there seemed to be so little to talk about. Actually, there's more than meets the eye. And to make much of it intelligible and factual, we have to make enough digressions into related fields to need some time for clarification. So in proper spirit, we start this evening with a digression, but it is relevant to the subject. Two theories have long existed as to how the cultural life of mankind spread throughout the world. The first of these theories assumes that the plateau of mankind rises collectively over a long period of time, that there is a universal evolution pressure that moves behind all peoples, pressing them forward, and that this motion has as its exceptions only a few groups of minor importance that in one way or another have been left behind or have been unable, through decadence or through the inferiority of bloodstream, to maintain the general pace. This would mean, at least theoretically, that throughout the world the mere fact that a nation or race comes into existence implies that were it solitary and alone, without contact with any other group, it would slowly evolve its own culture and would finally level off with the common culture of the world. There are many strong advocates of this idea, and it has quite an attractive appeal. We like to think of it also with individuals, that the person is moved by forces which, regardless of what he does, will ultimately bring him into the level of his kind, so that by the mere circumstance of birth, he is destined for a noble place among his contemporary cultures. The second theory, or attitude, is that culture actually moves from centers, and that these centers form what has been called a symphonic cultural theme, that people after people, race after race, will be touched by a certain common motion contributed from centers of culture or from neighboring peoples or by the rise of a particular group whose achievements will be spread over an area. Therefore, what we call the rise of peoples is actually the result of their coming into contact with other peoples, coming into contact particularly with cultures superior to their own. Now, we know this presents a basic problem, and if we wish to hypothetically assume that the first man had to grow that way, we would be having trouble locating the superior culture to which he is indebted. Thus, we have a situation which has to be thought through rather carefully. We cannot, however, at any point in our study, take the time to advance the general study of primogeniture. We cannot know who came first or who had the preceding ability. Our primary concern now is to determine a theory, or to make it as reasonable and practical as we can. If, therefore, we wish to assume that all peoples have a common impetus behind them and left to their own devices and isolated in a jungle or in a swamp or on an island, will still develop parallel attainments with other peoples, then we may assume that the Chinese enrich their culture without any reference to outside powers, and if there are certain similarities between the arts and cultures of China and those of Egypt, these similarities are accidental. They are simply the result of individuals working out problems, and because of reasoning powers which they possess, arriving at similar or even identical conclusions. Against this theory, however, is something else which we cannot completely disregard, namely that various areas of the Earth's surface have certainly produced widely different cultures. There is not merely one story behind the growth of human life. There are several basic stories. And these stories do not fit into this idea that all persons or all groups must inevitably arrive at the same conclusions. Rather, we know that we can divide the progress of mankind into streams or rivers, of which there become several prominent streams. These streams may mingle, but their identities are never lost. And at some remote time in the future, these individual streams can separate again and continue on their own ways without being completely absorbed into any other cultural motion. This leaves us with certain problems which can be approached in one way or another. A French writer, in a work called The Migration of Symbols, attempted to show, as Wilson did with his swastika migrations, that certain symbols moving about the earth, traveling very slowly but inevitably from culture to culture, become, so to say, the footprints of borrowings. That the motions of these basic symbols can be used to prove how ideas are transferred from one group to another. The swastika migration is an excellent example of that. This very primitive glyph appears upon the most primitive and crude stone carvings. As a pictoglyphic representation, it is to be found on the rocks and cliffs of our own Southwest. This same emblem appears among the Nordic peoples of Scandinavia, Finland, and those areas. It is strong in India and in China, and it is to be found wherever cultural groups seemingly have some contact with each other. The passing of this swastika symbol is certainly widely noted. Pottery designs are another stream, which including such devices as the swastika, certain primitive bird symbols, animal symbols, geometric forms and structures, seem to travel according to distinct routes through the mysteries of the ancient world. Another interesting migratory symbol is the bow and arrow, a primitive instrument of both defense and offensive warfare. And do not think for a moment that when we say bow and arrow that we are exhausting the theme. Even this simple device is susceptible of numerous types, kinds, and forms, which are highly individualistic and which can also be traced. Now we know, for example, that we can trace the migration of the bow and arrow down from the Bering Straits along our own western seaboard. In fact, we can trace it practically throughout the United States. But for some unknown reason, when we come to the borders of Mexico, we lose it. Why did this bow and arrow not proceed down through the peninsula of Yucatan? We do not know. These people do not seem to have originally possessed this instrument, although later, of course, they became aware of its use. Their primitive instrument was the atlatl, the throwing stick. And this was their ancient and traditional weapon. Thus, this migration of the bow and arrow does not completely cover all areas any more than the swastika does, or the monolithic construction of ancient times, or certain types of drawings, carvings, and pottery, ornamentation, beadwork. the scarification of the skin, the development of various totems, taboos, and things of this nature. These all can be traced, and from their elaborate tracings, we are inclined to support the belief that these things did migrate, that there is a strong case for the belief that culture was contagious, that it passed from one people to another. We have already pointed out that nearly all ancient nations trace their origins to preceding nations, or to messengers, or to teachers, messiahs, and godlings, who brought to them a higher degree of culture than they, as primitive peoples, possessed. Thus, most nations do not claim to have originated their arts and sciences, but to have received them, either from the gods or from some other preceding cultural group. This leads us then gradually into the theme which we wish to emphasize tonight. For we are seeking further evidence of the Atlantic migrations, the Atlantic philosophy, and the Atlantic symbolism. And we want to start with a consideration of certain areas covered a number of years ago by the African explorer, anthropologist, and ethnologist, Leo Frobenius. Frobenius did a tremendous work in quietly meditating upon the origin of African culture. He realized that he was in the presence of a very ancient people. He realized also, as historians have since noted, that he was privileged to know only the remnants of this people. That wherever you turn in Africa, you are in the presence of traditions, of legends, of fables and myths, of allegories and doctrines, and also of the most strange, bizarre, and extravagant symbols. And Frobenius came to the conclusion that there were two distinct African cultures. One of these cultures was apparently indigenous. It originated somewhere within the boundaries of the African area. The other culture was not actually indigenous, although it had been resident there for a very long time. He strengthens his position by showing that there are at least two basic concepts of life held in Africa, that these concepts of life are essentially irreconcilable, and that also these concepts represent distinctly different levels of social origin. One concept is considerably more exalted than the other. One concept indicates a greater experience background than the other. One, the more primitive, would be likely in the area. It would be consistent with the gradual emergence of a very primitive human type, a type gradually struggling its way through thousands of years to final adjustment with its environment. The other type shows a completely different background. One of the points that Frobenius makes is that the indigenous type is dominated and permeated with a strange, subtle humility. It is the humility of the child, the humility of the primitive, of that which is growing up in a world of wonder. And these simpler peoples have never come into conflict with their environment. They grow up truly, as he calls them, children of nature. They accept everything without doubt, with infinite patience, and if necessary, with mortal suffering. These people do not seem to have any grandeur in them. They do not seem to require it. They are certainly God's meek. And they have their own ways and their own happiness. They are not a miserable people. But they are a people of childlike disposition. Like small children, they can be difficult. Like small children, they can be headstrong. But underneath it all, there is very little innate sophistication. The other group, which seemingly comes from a totally different cultural level, is penetrated and permeated throughout its structure with a strange hauteur, with a mysterious grandeur, with a sense of descent from great and noble forebears. This second group, therefore, is composed essentially of the proud, those who raise their heads high, those to whom simple ways are not enough, those in whose social and political structure there are evidences of complexes of greatness, whose social code is involved and complicated and bound with numerous obligations, whose religion is deep and ancient and demands a great deal of self-discipline and self-control. These strange peoples are not simply children of nature. They have already reached that cultural platform in which they seek to dominate nature, that they seek to be strong and to use nature. They have already come to that time in which they will not accept inevitables, but will struggle against them to the death. These people have always had a proud heritage, and among them also there has been an astonishing maturity of arts and considerable basic growth in sciences. These peoples have much more cleverness, much more astuteness than those other tribes which seem to belong to a simpler stock. Most of all, perhaps, these proud ones, these ancient ones, like the brave, heroic, gigantic Ashantis, have this background of nobility. They dream back to kings and emperors and great empires. They look back upon a time in which they had vast temporal powers that have slipped away. And they believe and remember how their civilization was created by 16 gods who, descending from the skies, established these people as chosen, set apart and dedicated for a strange and wonderful destiny. Thus these strong, mysterious peoples feel themselves to be moved by a destiny, to have a purpose or a reason. Ambition has been born in them. Pride has grown in them. And we no longer have these simple, primitive peoples. This does not mean that the proud ones live visibly in great splendor. They do not. But comparatively, they live in a different way. Theirs is not the simple jungle village. Theirs is the town with broad avenues and streets, with palaces for their chiefs and rulers, with temples for their gods, with the actual architectural foundation of a mature community. These people believed in broad thoroughfares, in clean towns and villages, and they lived together on a level of considerable cultural refinement. They held obligations with sacredness. They kept their word. They punished their criminals. They rewarded the good. They sought the advice of the old and the wise. And these peoples applauded wisdom, regarded as it important, and held high offices open to the learned. Whereas among the more primitive people, leadership was mostly in the hands of the physically strong. So these other groups had reached the point where they appreciated strength of mind above strength of body. And they did not really feel that they had grown up out of the jungle. They felt that they had been exiled into the jungle from a better state, from some ancient background that was real and deep and valuable. As might also be expected, these people were more belligerent, more aggressive, more likely to defend their domains. And when European nations came into contact with them, they found them much more difficult to colonize or to control or to subjugate because among these natives there was this sense of great dignity, and they refused to regard themselves merely as waifs in the African hinterland. They held themselves to be equal to any person who could come to them, and they wished to be treated as equals by the greatest, the bravest, and the strongest. Frobenius makes quite a careful study of these two types as telling something that is worth thinking and thinking about and remembering. Now, in the area which we call today Nigeria, which is divided into two general areas also, northern and southern Nigeria, we have the center of this particular aggressive, positive culture. Nigeria is on the west coast of Africa, above the center, and overshadowed by the great northern area of the African continent. It is somewhat east of Liberia, and is not very far from the British colony of Lagos. This Nigerian area has always been distinguished for a very progressive and intelligent people, capable of accepting learning, perhaps more rapidly than most of the other African areas. Now, in this particular group, in this situation, or contiguous to it, we have a number of cultures arising which are important. One was the culture of Benin. Benin was first open to the Western modern European, who contacted this African tribal unit with astonishment. Great Benin was a city ruled over by an ancient aristocracy. It was ruled over by a proud and splendid ruler. And this city was rich with treasure and achievement. It had magnificent arts and crafts. It had a dignity, a sedateness, a maturity, an absolute atmosphere of a metropolitan existence, long before it had been contacted by European traders or missionaries. Another area in the same general group is Ife. And the Ife people are noted for their bronze casting. Most of the ancient casting in bronze in Africa is done in this general region, involving Yoruba, Benin, and Ife. In these groups, the art of using bronze was brought to a very high degree of skill, and the Ife masks and carvings and the great Benin heads, amulets, and even chain armor, their helmets and their crowns, their swords and their ceremonial instruments are of a very superior degree of workmanship. Their ancient legends tell us that this ability to work bronze was given to them by very ancient leaders who came from a distant place. In any event, this work in bronze has intrigued archaeologists ever since it has first been noted. Unfortunately, as the result of an accident, but involving an expedition against Benin because of its attack upon colonial civilians, in the course of trying to destroy some of the political aggression of this tribe, their city accidentally was burned. No one intended to burn it, but it was one of those unfortunate incidents which often accompany war. And in the destruction of their city, the heat destroyed most of their bronze artifacts. So that good examples of this type of work are comparatively rare and fetch a very high price in the market. But they are, without doubt, one of the strongest, most important forms of primitive art. They are perhaps among the greatest of folk art, so great that today the most sophisticated European and American collector congratulates himself if he can possess a genuine example of this work. It is a very high degree of craftsmanship. Now, these people are surrounded by other groups who have no such knowledge, have never practiced such arts, and are considerably less advanced in most of their social organizations. Frobenius, considering this carefully, would like to think that two cultures exist, therefore, in this African area. And while he does not actually say so, he is inclined to believe that the so-called primitive culture is much older than this sophisticated culture, that the primitive culture represents an almost unchanging primordial state down through the ages, a culture which will respond to civilizing influences much more slowly than that in these important but limited areas. He considers the second group to be more recent, yet of course ancient, but having achieved a great deal more of pressureful progress. Progress due to incentive and drive within the people itself. That they therefore represent two kinds of stock. And Frobenius definitely states in his book that he believes that the Ife people and the Yorubi and the Benin people are actually Atlanteans. He has studied the Atlantic theory very carefully, and he bases his contention upon a series of important factors. First, he has analyzed not only the cults, the crafts and arts of these people, but their religious cults. He observes in the religion of this area the tremendous veneration for the sea god. These people claimed or believed that they descended from a god of the oceans. This sea god corresponds very closely with the Poseidon of the Greek legends. These people also had deep and distant memory of great cities, and most of all of an archetypal concept of the palace and the temple. Most of your African people have no such archetypal concept, but these groups recognize what Frobenius calls the archetypal templum, the idea of the great and glorious sanctuary in the center of the life of the people. These people also differ from other African tribes in their attitude toward the gods and the deities. To them, these deities are not ghosts, and therefore they cannot be regarded as simple animists, as some would like to believe. Frobenius discovered sufficient information to convince him that the hierarchy concept, the divine development of peoples from a god origin, was known to these groups and was part of their mystery ritual. Also, the Yorubis and others were perfectly aware of the existence of one supreme deity. They were not subject merely to nature worship. They did not simply offer various sacrifices to animate or inanimate objects, or devote themselves completely to the fetishes and talismans and jujus of African tribes. They had a strong central theological concept, a concept in which all men and mortals descended from divine parentage, that the gods came first. And in their effort to describe and to symbolize these gods, they reached into the subconscious of their own collective memory and brought forth noble and glorious convictions about these deities. Your truly primitive person does not do this. He grows up into his religion. But these people, such as the Ife, had the realization of a tremendously brilliant, glorious, divine world, a world of heroes, a world of persons possessing unusual talents, so that their gods were almost the equal, if not the equal, of the gods of the Latins and the Greeks. Heroic beings, possessing not only the strength of body and of mind, but graces and qualities. For among these people, the gods of mercy were not unknown. The gods who should be thanked for the goodness of living were not unknown. Frobenius, therefore, comes very strongly to the belief that these peoples did have a strong background contact with a more sophisticated and unfolding culture platform or culture concept. Now, another group of archaeologists and students moving in on this subject and remembering, as several of them did, the possibility of the Egyptian being a remnant of the Atlantean Empire, the Atlanteans who could not go home after the Athenian campaign because of the destruction of their continent, that the Egyptian might hold the clue to the mystery of Atlantis in Africa. The Egyptian does hold certain clue, there is no question about it. Budge, in his study of Osiris and the Egyptian resurrection, shows the motion southward from Egypt of the cultural stream of the Egyptians. He reminds us that for a long time the Egyptian empire was under the dynastic rulership of Ethiopian kings. And Budge is also quite certain that down in Central Africa, particularly in the area of the Ashanti, there is great evidence that these people migrated from Egypt, moving southward at a remote period and gradually falling away from the high level of culture to a comparatively lower level, that they were isolated from contact with the greater things that had moved them and dominated them, so that they finally relapsed into a more or less primitive state. As a proof of this particular point, Budge and several others have shown the resemblances between the ornamentations, the artifacts, the jewelry, adornment, rituals, and so forth, of the present Ashanti and the ancient pieces excavated in the classical Egyptian area. There is much, therefore, to show that a comparatively high culture moved downward from North Africa into the central parts of the great African continent. Frobenius and many others have long felt that the legends and myths centering around the more inaccessible parts of the African continent should still be given a great deal of consideration. They believe that we may discover on that continent in time evidences of a very ancient and very high civilization, that we may sometime come upon ancient cities that will be as glorious as Corinth or Ephesus, that we may find ruins of magnificent palaces and temples belonging to a culture that has completely vanished from memory. When we say from memory, we mean from all memory except that of these primitive tribes which have retained a half-memory, a memory which is reserved mostly and revealed through their arts, through their instinctive reactions to things, and through the strange lordliness of their manners and of their broad attitudes toward life. So let us assume for a moment the possibility that Frobenius and these others are telling us that in Africa we have two levels of culture, one Lemurian and the other Atlantean, that these patient, mysterious, silent, humble ones belong to the old Lemurian order, and that what we call today the proud African, the Ashanti warrior who may stand over 7 feet tall, The Ife, who has never for one moment acknowledged actual domination by anyone. The wonderful artisans who created the bronze and the ivory work which has distinguished Benin. These belong to the Atlantean level. Now, in passing, there is a point that is rather interesting. In the second and third century of the Christian era, there arose in North Africa a group called the Gnosis. The Gnostics had a symbol, a very interesting and remarkable symbol. This symbol was a human body, usually with the head of a rooster, sometimes, however, with the head of a man. The arms and shoulders quite clearly defined, one hand holding a whip and the other a shield. The lower part of the body, below the waist of this figure, slowly turned into serpents, so that the legs were composed of two curved serpents. And these serpents formed a strange type of design. The legs descended and then turned outward and up again as the shape of the serpent and ended in the serpent's heads. It was quite a strange thing, resembling a little bit the inverted form of the hook that was used with a hook and eye in old fastenings before we had zippers. This hook and eye consisted of two loops by which the hook could be sewn onto the garment. And this form was very much that particular shape. I don't like to just draw it in the air for you. It might seem strange, but the symbol you will find in our large book, and we have other books in the library which we can show you. But the Gnostic deity Abraxas was represented in this way. We have no record of the use of the Abraxas form for centuries until it was revived at a very much later date in Italy and France during the restoration of the copying of classical gems and of ancient artifacts, in which during the period of Louis XIV we have the arriving of these wonderful crafts which were restored from ancient crafts. But a traveler reaching Great Benin before its destruction was permitted to see some of the ancient bronze work representing the ruler. In harmony with other peculiarities of this rite, the ruler of Benin was always represented as standing with his hands in this position and an assistant holding under each elbow. In other words, a servant or perhaps a counselor or perhaps a prince of the house had the honor or dignity of standing one on each side and holding up the hands and arms of the ruler. The ruler perhaps had this requirement because he carried very heavy bronze ceremonial objects, which perhaps were so heavy that it was necessary for someone to help him maintain them in this outstretched position. But anyway, a figure stood on each side holding up the arms of the obi, or the king, or the prince, so represented. The interesting thing is that the lower part of the body of the ruler ended with these serpent legs turned up and out again, exactly like the figures of the Gnosis in the second and third century of Egypt. No other place on earth does the Gnostic symbol appear, except in the area around the Ife culture. This has caused several persons to question whether at some time there was not a strong cultural tradition moving southward out of Egypt and going further and further into the mysterious hinterland. Now, in this also we have legends, as Budge and Breasted have both pointed out. And these legends would seem to indicate that the Ashantis and other peoples in the Central African area, who had apparently migrated southward from Egypt did so to escape the persecutions that resulted in the destruction of their religions. That these people represented a kind of high priesthood that moved south very much in the same way as the legends tell us another form of the Egyptian religious body moved into Europe to become the gypsies after the collapse of the classical civilization in the delta of the Nile region. In any event, these peoples of Central Africa claim to possess certain secrets, certain knowledge, certain sacred arts and sciences, and also that they have never lost their knowledge of the mystical arts and the magical practices of the ancient Egyptians. Here then comes another one of these migration factors. Your migration of magic is one of the most fascinating and extraordinary of all these themes. Magic moved upon a level. It traveled into distant places, always associated with certain rites and ceremonies. And these rites and ceremonies assume the possession of certain knowledge. And this knowledge was apparently diffused among all the peoples that we now assume or suspect to have been Atlantean. For this reason, we may say that the magic of Ife and Yorubi is an entirely different magic from that of the witch doctors of the general African area. This magic of these superior tribes is based upon a kind of internal knowledge, a knowledge of things remembered, a knowledge secretly passed on. And because magic is always the basis of the secret society in African life, we are not surprised to find that among these people, the secret society is an extremely strong structure, just as it was with the American Indian. Just as we find in the Midi rituals and rites, and also in the Pueblo rites of the Southwest. These rituals have to do with the reception of the child or the young person into the religion of his tribe. And this religion includes the conferring of certain magical power. The power to achieve certain things through prayer, through meditation, through the cultivation of breath, through the preparation of magical symbols and designs like the Navajo sand paintings. There was always the magic ritual. Dr. Churchwood, not the Mu man, but his brother, who was a well-known archaeologist, Dr. Albert Churchwood points out that in the African religious rituals, we have, like in the case of the Han society in China, a drawing upon old religious beliefs, old legends, and old lore, anciently known, but then apparently forgotten. In the performance of their rites, nearly all primitive peoples do one of two things. They either make use of a highly involved structure which stands for the purpose as a permanent part of the furniture of their community, or else they build a particular and special structure according to ancient and traditional lines. And here we can step across into the Polynesian area and into the Pacific region and find certain definite parallels. Even in an area as near to us as the Hawaiian Islands, the religious initiation rites anciently included the construction of a kind of building practically identical with the Jewish tabernacle. It was divided into a larger and a smaller room and surrounded by an enclosed courtyard. An initiation consisted of advancing from the west to the east through the outer courtyard into the larger inner room and finally into the sanctum sanctorum, where stood or reposed the emblem or symbol of the divine power. The initiation included circumambulation, or the traveling about these rooms, the meeting of certain dangers and obstacles. And finally, in the final degree of the ritual, the communication of the essential mystery or secret of life. We find this also throughout the Polynesian area and down into the Dutch East Indies, into many regions where as yet we have made but slight effort to revive our knowledge of these cultures. Frobenius tells us something else that is of importance. He points out the peculiar effect of foreign religious imposition on the lives of these people. He points out that at various times these African natives have been converted to other faiths. They were, some of them, converted by Muslims. They have also been converted by Christian missionaries and peoples of that nature. And in many instances, these conversions have led to a considerable improvement in the social life of the primitive tribes. But wherever these conversions touched these high people, these strong people, something else happened. These people absorbed the new ideas, but were not converted. They fitted them into a pattern older than that which the missionary brought them. They accepted certain good things. They became aware, but they found a place for the new beliefs within the structure of their own, rather than being moved from their own into a new belief. He therefore comes to the conclusion that there has to have been, and still remain, a very great vitality in the convictions of these people, who were able to rationally adapt a new faith to their own, coming out with something that was better but still their own, a condition which we do not generally observe where these missionaries impact upon a truly primitive group. So we have these possibilities to think about. Now let us consider for a moment, both in the Polynesians and in the African area, something about this mysterious ceremonial of initiation, which may and often does include the construction of a temporary symbolic structure to represent a universal mystery. We would assume that the preparation of this structure would call upon their most ancient beliefs and ideas, and this is essentially true. So we find in working into the secret societies of Africa, we find, for instance, that they made mounds and arranged rocks and prepared certain designs, much as our own Plains Indians did. Always also creating labyrinths or mazes around and through which the candidates had to walk to symbolize, like the labyrinth of Crete, the mysterious and mortal involvement through which man passes. Discussing some of these points relating to the African thought, we can gain some interesting point. Their study of the heaven world, the universe from which this universe came, the orientation of our world in a space greater than this world, was known to the Yorubis and many of the other people. It was known to the people of Ife and also to the Ashanti. So what did they do? They symbolized the primitive world, the divine world, the home of the gods, by a mountain. They placed this in the form of a mound in the central or most sacred part of their ceremonial structure. It was from this mountain that life came. It descended down the mountain. It spread from this mountain all over the world. This mountain of the gods, or the heaven mountain, on the summit of which, in the sky, is the abode of the immortals, is certainly your Asgard, your Olympus, and your Meru. These people had some basic association with these older beliefs. From this mountain also there descended the will of the gods, the messengers, and the ancient ones, for the world was first populated by gods who descended from the mountain. In the ancient Indic culture, this mountain would have been the Meru, and the descent would have been upon the polar cap from which the great progressive development of continents was believed to have taken place. This Meru or Sumeru, this Mount Kailasa of modern India, represents without question to these people some part of the map of their homeland. The ancient symbolic representations of Atlantis indicate that the city of the Golden Gate was upon the side of a mountain, and that the entire Atlantic area was surmounted by a peak, which was the abode of the gods. This seemingly was the place of the sacred city, and the people of Africa also regarded their origin as from a divine world where there stood a sacred city, and that this sacred city was the abode of their most remote progenitors. It was a beautiful, glorious, golden, glowing city. It was far above anything belonging to this world. Therefore, it had to be divine. But it could well have been this same mysterious city of Atlantis, with its walls of orichalcum, as described by Plato. From this mysterious land came the memory of great things and the knowledge of arts and crafts, which were slowly perpetuated. This knowledge continued. But it was inevitable that the perpetuation of this knowledge should bring into manifestation the mystery system, the ritual. For in this ritual we have the communication to the young man of the wisdom of his tribe or the knowledge of his elders, and the mysteries were set aside to keep knowledge alive. This mystery system exists everywhere where there is a suspicion that the Atlantic culture touched. This mystery system was also associated with the university system, with schooling. And many of the old temples were also observatories, laboratories, places like clinics where the sick came to be healed. These old buildings, patterned apparently from a basic archetype, represented structures of universal learning existing originally in a remote world, a distant place. And as time went on and these peoples wandered from this land, they could no longer build such temples. They could no longer leave such monuments. But they left in the place of them symbolic ritualistic structures, each one of which was in memory of the great building. Higgins, in his Masonic researches, points out that scattered about the world are a series of magnificent and ancient ruins. Each one of these ruins is in a way equally mysterious. We have very little satisfactory account of their building or even of the time in which they were built. Many of them stand now deserted in jungles. What happened to their peoples, we do not know. Two good examples of these deserted areas, deserted even after the rise of European culture, would be Angkor Wat in Cambodia, the great center of the Khmer culture, and the peninsula of Yucatan, the great center of the later Maya culture in the Western Hemisphere. Both of these areas were deserted within the last 1,000 years. No one knows why. No one knows what happened to the people. And there is really no knowledge as to the basic design, purpose, or pattern beneath these great remains. We study them, however, and we come immediately to one realization. All these monuments are built upon one grand theme. In every case, they represent a complex of structures surrounding a central mountain, a great raised place in the middle. This raised place is usually surrounded by a square. And down the faces of the square descend the great staircases which lead to the four directions of the world. This is the motive in the central building of Angkor Wat, and it is the same motive exactly that we find in the temple of Kukulcan at Chichen Itza in Yucatan. Also, in Angkor, there is a great balustrade of serpents. And at Angkor, there is the same development of the great sea serpent theme. This comes back to us at Chichen Itza, where the balustrades of the Great Pyramid are conventionalized serpents. And at the foot of each of the great staircases is the head of the serpent. Thus, the combination of the pyramid and the serpent occurs in many areas. And wherever the pyramid arises in mythology and legendary, it is universally assumed that it represents a great mountain. It is a symbol of the world mountain, the mother mountain. The great mountain of the Jains in India, which is the axis mountain of the earth. Also, this mountain is always the abode of the gods. And always in the uppermost and highest part of this mountain will be the sanctuary of the deity. At Jakarta in Java, we have also the great Buddhist monument, the Borobudur. Here we have likewise the basic square structure surmounted by circular terraces, climaxed or crested with a daboba or tower, which originally contained a relic of Buddha. Up each of the faces ascend the staircases, and the ornamentations include serpents and dragons. All these buildings, therefore, have something to do with the Book of Revelation, where there is a reference to the city four square with its gates, and in the midst of which is the glory of the Lamb. In Africa, in Polynesia, in China, in India, in ancient Greece, North America, South America, Central America, this theme is infinitely repeated. And it is the opinion of a great many scholars that there is only one reasonable solution to this, namely that we are in the presence of the dominant culture theme of the Atlantean era or epic. Namely, that the great symbol of the Atlantic world was their own glorious city. The city from which all of their culture came, their university temple city, and that all these mountains represent the great temple of Poseidon, ruler over Posidonis. This wonderful temple on the top of a peak, or at least well on the side of a mountain, and remembered as a kind of center where learning, wisdom, and the divine laws were kept.